It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Iowa Week. All this week on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we're exploring unexpected Iowa. And today, some of the finest instrument makers in the world live and work in Iowa. I will talk with three of them. And later in the hour, Iowa's surprising role in the development of electronic music. Now, you're probably not in the market for a new pipe organ, but if you were, Lake City, Iowa might be the first place you should look. Lynn Dobson is the founder and owner of Dobson Pipe Organ Builders in Lake City. He's on the line with me now. Hello, Lynn.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Now, you were born and raised in Lake City, Iowa. How did you get into the pipe organ building business?
Well, I always enjoyed organ music and from a very early age. And then as I got a little older, I was mechanically inclined. And so I became interested in the, in how they worked. And I started working with a service company while I was in college and eventually worked for another organ company who built new organs. And then I went on my own.
Was there a particular organ when you were growing up that captured your imagination?
Well, I have to say that when I was probably 10 or 11, we went to Utah, and our family went to a concert at the Tabernacle. And, of course, that's one of the biggest organs in the country, and it was certainly an exciting experience that I'll never forget.
And you actually, when you were in college, you built an organ on your own?
Well, actually what happened was that I was in an industrial design program, and a senior project was to design something that involved mechanics and things like that. And so I actually designed an organ for that class. And then after I was out of college, I built that organ, and it's now in a church. It was in Sioux City and has just recently been moved to a church in Dunes. I can't think of the name of the town right now.
So where did you build it?
In my dad's barn on the farm.
Wow. So as you got more and more involved in organ repair and building, what made you decide to start your own company?
I was working with another company, and I guess I just decided that I could be more creative if I was designing the organs myself. And I have a degree in art and also industrial design. So, it just seemed like the right thing to do.
In thinking about starting a business, building pipe organs, did you think that it was going to be possible in Lake City, or was that always a given for you?
Well, I think when I decided to build organs and start my own shop, it was a matter of cost. I could find, a building here in Lake City that was available, and it didn't cost a lot. It didn't cost a lot to live here. And so, frankly, at the time, I had no idea how the business would go. I'm not sure that at the time I was even thinking of it as a business. It was just like, I'm going to build organs, and I had no idea where it would go. So, being in a location where it was, less cost was my primary thought, I suppose.
Now, of course, you don't have a showroom with a bunch of organs sitting around that buyers can come and look at. You are commissioned to build organs. How do your clients find you?
Well, it's mostly word of mouth, actually, from the very start. I built this organ after after I was out of college, and I was interviewed, in fact, on a radio program, and some people heard that program and called me up later and wanted to buy the organ and put it in their church. And so that happened, and then the organist that came to play the dedication asked me about 6 weeks after the dedication if I would build an organ for his studio, and it sort of went from there. The next project was in Minneapolis, and it's always been a word of mouth sort of thing. We do some advertising in organ journals, but ultimately the work always comes from people who play the organs and, you know, like the sound, like the way they look.
So if someone is planning to build a new or commission a new pipe organ for their institution, do they travel around and try out different organs?
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. Unlike smaller instruments that can be carried around and shown, people have to travel to see the organs. And so we've often had, because we did a number of instruments up in the Minnesota, Minneapolis area early on, people used to fly to Minneapolis and play the organs there. And then after we got projects in Arizona and North Carolina and Pennsylvania, then, you know, people can go to those places. So that's how it travels.
Now, you got a lot of attention about a year ago because you were building a pipe organ for a chapel at the University of Oxford, obviously an incredibly prestigious project. What's the largest pipe organ you've ever built?
Well, so far, the largest organ that we've ever built was for the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. It's the home of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and that organ has 125 ranks of pipes, almost 10,000 pipes. And now we're building an even larger one for St. Thomas's Church in New York City, and that organ we're working on it right now, but it'll be finished in 2018.
And do you build the parts in Lake City and then transport them?
Yes, we build everything here. We do all the design work, and we make metal pipes and wood pipes and all the wind chests and, you know, everything other than blowers and some of the hardware that's used.
What do you think makes your organs stand out? What are you most proud of?
Well, I would have to say that, first of all, they're very musical, and people love the sound that they produce. Most organs have to fulfill both two roles, as a solo instrument, but also as an accompaniment to the human voice. And I would say that people always notice that it's very easy to sing with our organs. And the other thing that's distinguished them is the visual design. I have a degree in art, sculpture in particular, and so, that shows itself in the visual designs that I do.
Do you play the organ?
I'm actually not an organist.
So as you're putting this together, do you have musicians that you work with to make sure that the musical part of the instrument is coming together as well as the mechanical part?
Sure. In fact, about half of the people who work here play the organ, and so they certainly they can play and demonstrate and test things out. And of course, we also work with consulting individuals, particularly in the larger projects that we work on. The church or institution, the college, would have an organ consultant who is usually an expert. And so those people also, have some input into the design and voicing of the instrument.
So you have 20 employees. Many of them are from Iowa, but there are a number of people who've moved to Iowa because they really wanted to work with you.
Yeah, that's right. We have people from New York and Wisconsin and North Carolina, Minnesota, Kansas, who've all come here. So, and they come here because they specifically wanted to work with the sort of work that we do, as opposed to the work that other organ builders do.
It sounds like things are going well for your business, but it's also a time where things have changed a lot in churches with church music. Fewer churches are installing pipe organs. How does that affect your work?
Well, it's a little bit troubling to see, you know, the trends. On the other hand, the one thing that I've always felt is that if we build a really quality product, you know, that we'll always stay busy. And so far, that's been the case. We're one of the larger companies, certainly, in the United States right now.
Well, we are going to end this segment with a little bit of pipe organ music. And this is from Opus 78. That's what you call each commission. It's an opus, right?
That's right.
And this is an organ located in St. John United Methodist Church in Georgia. And how many opuses do you have to your name? How many organs have you built?
We're working on Opus 93, and we have a couple more contracted after that. So hopefully by the time I retire, I'll build at least 100 organs.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for calling.
Lynn Dobson is the founder and owner of Dobson Pipe Organ Builders in Lake City. Coming up, we'll talk with two more master craftsmen about the instruments they make. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa and River to River. We're exploring unexpected Iowa. And this hour, we're focusing on craftsmen who create instruments that are in demand all over the world. With me now is Randy Jones. He is a woodwind repair specialist. He's also a saxophone specialist and the owner of Tenor Madness in Cedar Falls. Hello, Randy.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Now, I can understand being a woodwind repair specialist, focusing on woodwind instruments, but what made you think that you could have a store in Cedar Falls, Iowa, that almost focused exclusively on saxophones?
Good question. As a guitar player, primarily, I listened to saxophones my whole life, and I've worked very closely with the music staff at the University of Northern Iowa over the years, and the obsession came from starting working with all the woodwind family, and eventually I found that I liked working with especially saxophones, and I used to have a customer in Chicago that used to bring his instruments to me, and through word of mouth he had me come in contact with a gentleman in New York, and he had a large dealership at the time, and he used to put pallets full of saxophones and ship them here, and then I would work on them, and then we'd put them on a pallet and ship them back to New York, and from there it was all word of mouth. Pretty much.
Well, I know that you have actually started your own brand of saxophones, and I want to talk
sure.
about those in a moment. But first, you kind of specialize in a particular vintage of saxophones. Explain that to me.
That is correct. Probably the most in demand saxophone today is the Selmer Paris saxophone. And particularly in the collector's market, it's a saxophone that was made. The range that I deal with primarily from the mid to late 1930s to the early part of 1960s. And this is a time period where many people believe this was the best instrument that was ever being made. And so that's what I focused on. So pretty much at any given time, a large portion of my revenue comes from Mark Sixes, which we have people calling us from all over to either sell the instrument or for us to do a restoration on them, or for us to buy and sell to other customers.
And you actually have an employee who spends about 4 or 5 hours a day on the internet just searching for this kind of saxophone?
Yes, learning how to deal with the internet. Yeah, I mean, that's what he does. I mean, my business was started before eBay existed, and that's part of learning how to make the business grow. The gentleman that you're speaking of has his master's degree from DePaul as a performer, and he comes in, and that's the first thing he does. There's Craigslist, there's eBay, there's watching other sites where people may post saxophones for sale, and then that's a big part of his day. And then, of course, answering the phone for the customers that are asking questions.
So what makes what you do so special? The saxophones that we're talking about right now are already in existence.
Correct.
What makes your repair work something that people from all over the world are seeking out?
I think part of it is just the passion. I surround myself by saxophone fanatics, pretty much. And, you know, I think we spend a lot of time helping people pick the right instrument, which is, it's not, you can't open up a page and say, oh, this is the best deal. There's a whole conversation or dialogue that goes on between my sales staff and the customer purchasing the horn. Could be, you know, who they would like to aspire to sound like, what horns they've played in the past that they've really liked, even things like physical stature. You know, if we're setting up a saxophone for someone and he's 6'5", that is very different than if we're setting up a saxophone for someone that's 5 foot. And so it's all about gaining information of the potential customer.
And you have musicians. I mentioned Sonny Rollins earlier, pretty much exclusively plays instruments that you've worked on, right?
Well, there's a lot of people that have visited my shop. Craig Handy, Chris Potter, Joshua Redman, Michael Brecker, when he was alive, had been to our shop several times. Eddie Daniels, there's a pretty good list, but again,
you've got an A list of musicians traveling to Cedar Falls,
correct,
Iowa, to come to your shop.
Yeah, it's
and
been
play
great.
Your saxophones.
Yeah, it's been fun. Again, it's because there's not that many shops out there that actually just specialize in Selmer Parra saxophones.
Now, you have just started your own brand, the TM Specialty.
Correct.
And you've started making saxophones. You have a woman not far from Cedar Falls who hand engraves the bells for your saxophones. How many have you sold so far?
The last order that came in last week was around 700.
Wow.
So, which, small numbers, you know, compared to a lot of major brands, but for something that's completely hand assembled in our shop, that's we're doing quite well.
And how do you build a saxophone from scratch?
Well, it's not from scratch. That was a big thing I was trying to decide 4 or 5 years ago. And it has to do with just what it takes to build a saxophone. And what I did was look around the world and try to find the best materials I could work with. And I was very lucky to find one company in Taiwan that would work with me and basically build an instrument to my specs, except for would we bring them over here, then we take them all apart and then put our own spin on the instrument.
Okay.
And it's more or less blueprinting. And there's a lot of the materials that we add to the horn that are here. The pads, for let's say, are made in France. There's a specialty thing called a tone booster that is actually made by a machine shop down in Des Moines, Iowa, for me. And a lot of the materials that I look for, you know, are found somewhere else in the industry. And
you're getting quite a following for your own horns. I know that the
yes.
lead tenor from the Count Basie band.
Yes, he's been playing my horn for about 2 years now.
And a TM is going to be featured in a movie, right?
Right. And, you know, I'm embarrassed. I don't even know what the film is. It's just being released this month.
You're going to have to work on your ego, Randy, and become a little better movie star here.
Yeah, but it should be great. I mean, the gentleman that the band that he plays with, he said there's like a 3 or 4 minute segment where they're playing in a bar, and he's all excited that my horn was going to be in the front.
Well, Randy, thank you so much for talking with me today. And we're going to leave you here, Randy, with a little bit of some music performed by Doug Lawrence. I mentioned he's the lead tenor soloist for the Count Basie band. He's playing a TM Custom. So this is a saxophone that Randy Jones of Tenor Madness in Cedar Falls made. Listen to that all day. We're going to move from saxophones now to string instruments. And with me is Jim Reck. He is the owner and founder of Reck Violin Shop in Iowa City. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Charity.
Or in Coralville, pardon me.
That's all right.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And now, you started as a concert musician playing the cello.
Mm-hmm.
What was your evolution? Because you repair instruments, but you also build your own instruments.
Well, my beginnings were primarily being a cellist and spending my spare time studying with repair people and trying not to spend too much time doing that. But it's one of those things that when you have trouble finding someone to work on your cello or instrument, you try to figure out some way to make it sound better. So that was one of my solutions. And so through high school and college, I'd spend summers studying with people. And I found I spent even one summer building a pipe organ, installing it in a church, which I don't know how that relates to this, but it just kind of increases my interest in music in general. And coming here for graduate school, I had, you know, created quite a backlog of knowledge in terms of repairing instruments. And even in my undergraduate days, I drove many roommates away by repairing bows with the smell of hide glue and burning hair. And it's just something that I just was always drawn to. But then being here in Iowa City, my wife and I found that not only is it a really unique community, just this whole area and the amount of music going on, there was a real need for some string repair work, and there really weren't any shops that just specialized in that kind of work. And so my beginnings were primarily doing restoration and repair work. And after a few years of working at a local music store, I you know, basically had the opportunity to start my own business. And it's gone pretty well after 27 years, and we're pretty happy. But the instrument making part really started around 1990, and it was out of necessity of providing an instrument for one of my kids who was studying double bass and couldn't find the right size instrument for her. And so I thought, okay, I've torn apart so many instruments, I know what goes into making one of these things. So that's how it all started.
Really? So the first thing you built was a bass?
A double bass, yes.
So in doing that, I mean, what? How do you start? I know that, you know, people have such an intimate relationship with their instruments. We hear these stories about, you know, different instruments that are worth millions of dollars that musicians will buy a first class ticket for on an airplane and travel around the world with. So when you want to start from scratch, I'm going to make a double bass. What do you do? How do you start?
Well, you know, it's a lot of the same techniques I use in restoring or repairing instruments as far as carving, installing purfling, doing repair work. You really have all the tools you need pretty much to start with. And it's just a matter of finding the correct materials and well-seasoned wood that'll give a good tone. And it's that gets to be a much more difficult part of the building process. And I found some good sources. Sometimes they have wood, sometimes they don't. But it is kind of a challenge. And when you know exactly what it is you're trying to make the instrument do and sound like, you have to be pretty picky about the sort of materials you're using. And basses are unfortunately an instrument that not a lot of, you know, instrument makers are interested in working with because they're quite large, take up a lot of space. And so there is kind of a demand for that, especially with the number of bass players we're seeing today. It's really growing. And I'm finding more and more demand. And once you build an instrument, people see it and hear it, and it's just something that you have to really pace yourself because I can only build two or three instruments a year, and even at that, I'm doing full-time repair work and helping people find instruments and bows and setting up instruments for people, and people come in from all over with Hancher and the Engler Theater here. We get all kinds, especially bass players. Christian McBride has used one of my basses before, and I don't know if you remember when Esperanza Spalding was here a couple of years ago. A lot of these guys don't travel with their own instruments because it's so risky. You mean
right,
your chances of an instrument being damaged in shipping or flying, it's not worth the risk. So they're coming here and they're able to find an instrument that they're happy with. So one of my basses was used on her concert. And so that's kind of fun to see people who are looking for a good instrument that's part of their career. I mean, this is important to them. They want something that works. And so it's been kind of fun for me to have that interaction with those people as well.
You are investing so much time. And of course, a handmade instrument is a real investment for people who are playing them as well. Is there sort of a critical point to the creation process? Is there a point where something can go wrong?
You know, if I was in the beginning stages of learning how to do this, yeah, I mean, when you have $2,500 or more invested in a piece of wood, you should be at a point where you're not going to make those kinds of mistakes. And usually, I mean, nobody's perfect. Mistakes are made. Every instrument you finish, you think, I will do this differently next time. But, you know, ultimately what you're trying to achieve from each piece of wood being so different than the next is getting the correct thicknesses and getting the flexibility just right and the tap tones and getting it so that it works in a way that I'm trying to achieve a certain thing for the customer. If they want a solo sounding bass or more of an orchestral bass, we look at different patterns and things like that.
Is there something that you feel gives your instruments a signature sound?
Well, I've been criticized for my basses sounding a lot like cellos. And I admittedly like the sound of the cello. It's an instrument that I play. And I have always thought of an instrument should be able to sing, and the cello has such a wide range. I said, well, there's no reason why basses can't sound like that. In the past,
I don't think that necessarily sounds like a criticism then.
It is, because a lot of people want this huge, growly, massive sound, which is not difficult to achieve. It's just that when the level of playing gets to a point where someone like Gary Carr or Edgar Meyer is, I mean, you look at the basses they play, they're not large basses. They're more solo basses. And more people are looking for that kind of sound, I think, as far as bass players are concerned. They want to be able to play box suites and things like that that are manageable. So I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, no, it sounds like a signature sound, which is exactly what I asked about. And you've got people now from all over the world contacting you.
You know, it's as a repair person, you kind of develop this relationship with customers. And being in a university town, these people are here for 3 or 4 years or 2 years and they leave, and then you think, okay, that's the last time I'll see that customer. Well, what happens is these people go to other places and there aren't people there to do work for them. And so people are always coming back. We're kind of in a great place in the middle of the country with Interstate 80 here. And so I'm constantly in touch with all these people that we've dealt with for years and years. And I have customers in Australia and South Korea. And my daughter plays in an orchestra in Sweden. And she's I'm actually delivering a bass for her next early November.
Wow. And, well, Jim, we're out of time.
Oh,
thank you so much for being
pleasure.
Here today. Jim Reck of Reck Violin Shop in Coralville.